The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. I think there's still some people walking around getting breakfast, but hopefully they'll join us. Welcome to Sustainable Development Law and Policy's annual symposium event. My name is Addie Hoy. I serve as one of the editors-in-chief of SDLP. First off, I'd like to thank our symposium editor, Mike DiStefano, who is not in the room at the moment because he's doing something important and vital to the running of this event. I'm not sure what that would be, but you'll be meeting him throughout the day as he'll be helping run the event, and he was integral in putting this together. I'd also like to thank Jennifer Dabson and all of the staff at WCL that helps make this possible for students and helps these events run smoothly so that we can continue on with our mission of educating students in the law. SDLP is rounding out its ninth year publishing at WCL. We produce three issues a year, including one, a foreign language issue that is translated into Spanish and French. We publish articles and essays that focus on reconciling the tensions between environmental sustainability, economic development, and human welfare. We embrace an interdisciplinary focus to provide a broad view of current legal, political, and social developments. I encourage you to pick up some recent copies of SDLP, which are out on the table with our CLE materials in the front as you came in. We all have a general idea of why China is an important topic for anyone talking about environmental progress. With nearly 10 million square kilometers of diverse and rich natural resources and 1.3 billion people steadily rising in economic status, China is a point of interest in any environmental discussion. Climate change, clean technology, water wars, deforestation, healthy air, and more. The topic of China often comes up amongst the staff of SDLP. Our talks about China are perhaps a little different than those of the past. We talk about watching the Olympics, Yao Ming, YouTube videos, commercials, past visits and vacations to China, future study abroad opportunities, and even job prospects in China. Just last semester, I sat in on an international environmental law class with multiple LLM students from China here studying at WCL. These discussions came up again when we were talking about possible symposium topics for 2009. This seemed like the right time and the right place to talk about China and the environment. Globalization has led to a wave of environmental crises, but it has also brought people together in new ways. It is in the spirit of a new connection with China and with the people of China that we came together today and are delighted to bring you this symposium. The panels today will provide a broad view of China and the environment and offer a platform for our guest experts to discuss a number of the most pressing sustainable development issues facing China and facing the world today. Today's schedule will be the following. The first panel will be called Going Green, the Development of Chinese Environmental Law, followed by Development's Human Cost, Human Rights and the Environment in China. And then we will have lunch right here outside, and then we will conclude the day with a panel called Giant Opportunity, China as a Partner in International Environmental Law. So without any further fanfare, we'll get started. Our first panelists include Mr. Roger Martella. He's a partner in the environmental practice group at Sidley Austin. He recently rejoined Sidley Austin after 10 years of litigating and handling complex environmental and natural resource matters at the Department of Justice and the EPA. Also with us this morning is Jake Schmidt, the International Climate Policy Director at the Natural Resources Defense Council. He leads their policy development and advocacy on international climate change, focused on the development of the post-2012 international response to climate change and the actions in key regions of the world to deliver on that agreement. He's actively worked in Brazil, China, India, and Mexico with key research institutions and government officials to analyze greenhouse gas mitigation options and develop strategies to implement the most promising options. And also joining us is Mr. Christopher Williams. He's a director of freshwater conservation at the World Wildlife Fund. He directs their work on international and national freshwater policy, supports their field projects all over the world, and develops partnerships for freshwater conservation with governments, corporations, foundations, and bilateral and multilateral aid agencies. Among the field projects that Chris oversees is a community-based pollution control program on the Yangtze River Basin in China. So Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Good morning, and thank you for that great introduction, and thank you for the honor of being here. This is a great panel, a great day that has been planned by the organization, and I can tell you, myself excluded, you truly have assembled throughout the day the experts on these issues in the United States, and it's an honor to be associated with them and an honor to be associated with this program. I've been asked to give something of a real general overview to kind of kick off the day on the status of the development of environmental laws in China. And this is something I have a fair amount of experience with. I left about a year ago as EPA General Counsel. And while I was General Counsel, I decided pretty early in my tenureship that we had a lot of experience in the United States that we could share with China in helping to develop environmental laws there. We had read so much about the condition of the environment. I came to the conclusion, well, you can't improve the environment until you improve the environmental laws. So we set up something called the China Environmental Law Initiative, and Steve Wolfson, who will speak later today, was the lead person for running the initiative, and he will be here this afternoon to tell you about the initiative and what they continue to do even after I left. So I became something of someone who learned a lot about Chinese environmental laws. I went back and forth a lot, and since I've left EPA, I've gone back to teach in law schools there, share some experiences with the U.S., share some experiences there, and I've also worked with NRDC and a number of our NGO colleagues in China in helping advance environmental laws. And one of the things I think it's very important to do, whether I'm speaking on this issue in China or in the United States, is to provide some context on the development of United States environmental laws, American environmental laws, because I first assumed when I went over there it would be a simple, straightforward matter of just simply looking at our laws and translating things and adopting to their system. And I soon learned that the distinctions were much greater than the similarities. And to understand really how Chinese environmental laws are developing, I think you have to have some appreciation for how our laws developed and make some comparisons between the two. And you'll hear a lot today from the speakers about the various statistics on what the condition of the environment is, what the condition of energy is, the condition of greenhouse gas emissions. I'm not going to go into that. I'm going to instead focus on some pictures and use pictures to kind of explain my perspective of how environmental laws are developing in China and how they developed here in the U.S. and what the similarities are. And I'm going to begin with a picture you've probably seen before. This is one of my favorite pictures. And it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. This is a picture, of course, from the 1930s in New York, the construction of Rockefeller Center, a critical time in the growth of the United States. And a lot of people look at this for different reasons. Sociologists will look at this and look at the role of immigrants in building the United States. Economists look at it and say this was a time of great construction. Architects look at it. I was in a hat store in Georgetown, and he had a picture of this because he thought all the hats were really cool. And I look at this, though, and I notice something that most people don't notice, and I notice the gray skies in the background. It almost looks like today in a way. But to me, I look at the pollution. I say, wow, there was a lot of pollution in New York at the time, and it wasn't just this one picture. If you look at other pictures from the same era, you get this distinct impression that New York had significant environmental problems during this period in history. And actually, into the 1970s. This is a picture of the construction of the World Trade Center and this French tightrope walker. I think they made a documentary recently. And again, the environment, if you remember, I guess, from the 1970s, had significant issues in New York. The Cuyahoga River, of course, was another factor leading to the development of U.S. environmental laws. This is a river that would spontaneously catch on fire as a result of industrial pollution during the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and was a significant factor in promoting clean water laws. Love Canal was a canal that was built in the 1920s by a chemical company, and was literally, well, it wasn't built by a chemical company, it was built actually to serve as a navigable canal. Chemical company started dumping chemicals there, they covered the thing up, and you can see they built houses alongside of it. This was probably the leading source of a movement for environmental issues in the United States. It was really the first time people made a connection between environmental laws and human health issues. And as a result of Love Canal, as a result of the quality of the air in major cities, as a result of the Cuyahoga River, in the early 1970s, we began to develop a very significant, the greatest environmental laws in the world to respond to these issues. But we have to keep in mind, there's a 40-year gap between those pictures of New York City. There's a 20, 30-year gap between the pictures of the Cuyahoga River and when we began to do this. And so when we talk about the development of Chinese environmental laws, I like to keep that perspective in mind. What we did as a result of environmental laws is we went to New York City, as it looked in the 30s, to New York City on most days today. The Cuyahoga River supports a very active fishing and tourism economy today, millions of dollars of fish economy in the Cuyahoga River. And Love Canal has become a very livable neighborhood for families of all sizes. And so again, it's been our environmental law framework that has enabled us to move past environmental issues. So let's turn back to this picture, the picture I started with. Again, New York in the 1930s. Well, where's China at today? We don't know where China's at because I think my clicker's not working. Suspense. There we go. So this was a picture taken by Steve Wolfson. Steve took most of these pictures. And so this is China, not today, but this was China about a year and a half ago in Shanghai. And the resemblances are striking. And they're more striking actually when you're there. You see all kinds of things in China that you would imagine we see from these pictures of the Cuyahoga River and other places today. And we did not pick out, and Steve will confirm this, we did not pick out the worst of the pictures. I actually tried to be pretty fair. I think these are typical pictures. A lot of days are worse. Some days are better. But I think on the most times, if you're in a large city in China, probably many of you have been, this would actually be a relatively good day on this picture because it's not entirely cloudy. And on some days, you wouldn't even be able to see those cranes in the background. This is, you know, a picture of Shanghai. Beijing, I think, is generally worse in Shanghai in terms of air quality, and a lot of the other cities are even worse than Beijing. But this is, if you're there for 10 days or 2 weeks or so, you're probably likely to see virtually every day in a big city with skies like this. You might see a part of a blue sky on a weekend in a large city. But you also see efforts. You see efforts to address environmental issues, and as soon as you step off an airplane in China, you'll see a lot of messages about improving environment and taking strong, sustainable efforts towards improving the environment. And this is from an airport in China where you can see they have a very sophisticated way of recycling. They have organic garbage, inorganic garbage, and pernicious garbage, which I, in all my trips there, have never figured out quite what to put in that one, but I'm sure some people know. But when you explore things a little further and go to a recycling facility, you're left with an impression of you're not really sure if the level of sophistication of the way they're addressing the problems is necessarily significant with the messages they're communicating on the outside. And this becomes something of a theme as environmental laws are developing in China. There's a distinction sometimes between how things appear on the surface and then what might be actually happening. Again, more pictures from Steve. This was taken on a weekend in Beijing. You can see the skies are a little better. And what we, you know, I went around and took pictures of smokestacks, which I think, again, is unusual. We look for different things than most tourists do. And I was deleting pictures on my camera card of you know, Tiananmen Square because I had to take more smokestack pictures. And the interesting thing about these smokestacks, and this one's about 30 miles outside of Beijing, is you see nothing coming out of them. That's not because they're being closely regulated. It's because they've been shut down. And you've heard lots of stories with the Olympics about smokestacks in the factories close into the city being shut down. And we found that to be largely true. There's not a whole lot of industrial operation around Beijing at the moment. But despite that, there's still tremendous pollution there. Now, this is a picture of Shanghai. I said I like to use pictures to demonstrate things. And, of course, this is an idyllic picture of crystal blue waters and clear blue skies. And this is really an image for what anybody would want a modern city to look like. And, unfortunately, the picture is not realistic. This is a picture we took of a picture of Shanghai that was being promoted. And, of course, the pictures that we have of Shanghai look much more like this. So my role as a lawyer and kind of working with both the Ministry of Environmental Protection, NGOs in China, academics in China, when I teach in China, I teach at a few universities there, is to do what we did in the United States, which is to use an environmental law framework to get from where things currently are to where they want to go. And I begin with the development of the United States because I do like to remind folks, I don't think it's always fair for us to merely point fingers because we've been there too, and frankly, it took us a long time, it took us many decades to really get our act together. And to some extent, China is addressing the environmental issues while they're going through economic growth. We went through a lot of economic growth without addressing environmental issues. There's lots of debates on how well they're addressing and how quickly they're addressing it, but they are focused on these issues, and a lot of the discussion today is going to be how strongly are they focused. One of the things we talk about when we're talking about environmental issues in China is they have even more significant challenges than we did, though. When we approached these issues like Love Canal and the Cuyahoga River in the 1970s, we had a single mission in mind. We wanted to basically right environmental wrongs. We wanted to correct harms of the past to make sure people could fish in the Cuyahoga River, to live near Love Canal, to undo the harm that had been done, and to make sure that we're trying to prevent future harm, that people aren't polluting like they used to and causing new issues. Today we're focused on a much broader range of environmental issues. We're focused on sustainability. We're focused on not only correcting past harms, but making the planet better for our future generations. And this leads to climate change and nanotechnology, endangered species, energy efficiency, and international issues. And so we're focusing more and more of our energy on that. China has the pressure of dealing with both challenges simultaneously. It has significant challenges, probably even more than we did in the 1970s, of addressing past environmental harms and preventing current environmental harms, while as the world's growing economy, eyes are turning to them to step up and be responsible for these new issues of sustainability and climate change and energy efficiency. So it has significant challenges both in kind of the existing environmental problems and the future sustainable problems. And what I want to do kind of on the last point here is talk about three points, which is the notion, how can they do this? How can they actually upgrade or modernize their environmental law system to do what we did and to put a strong framework to get from point A to point B? And again, the challenge here is it's not as simple as us saying, and you'll hear this from Professor Percival this afternoon, it's not as simple as us saying, we've got a Clean Water Act, here's how we did it, why don't we just do some translation and we'll make some modifications for your system of law and implement it wholesale and you can solve all your water problems. As we'll see in a second, that is, the systems are so fundamentally different that while we can learn from what we've done, it's nowhere near that simple. And as a matter of fact, when I was teaching last summer at one of the environmental law schools, it's considered one of the top 1-2 law schools in the country. One of my goals was to spend some time studying in the law library, just walking around the law library and trying to absorb their environmental laws. And I kept saying to students, I kept saying to librarians, where are your environmental laws? I'd like to see them. Where are your environmental laws? I really want to read them. I want to literally open the book and just start reading them. You know, you think of the U.S. Code, and you got shelves of U.S. Code and CFRs. Nobody knew what I was talking about. They didn't understand what I meant when I said I wanted to see their environmental laws. These are law students and law librarians who don't look to the laws as they're becoming lawyers, as they're practicing laws. I actually found them. It wasn't that hard to find. They were in a relatively easy place to find. And there were about 6 binders. Each binder was that thick. And those 6 binders represented all the laws in China, all the national laws. And you could find the index, and you could find the environmental laws, which was inside one binder, and was basically a pamphlet, what would be a supplement to one of our federal reporters. And you would thumb through it, and there was a general law on water, a general law on air, with very broad statements. And so it reinforces the notion of how fundamentally different the system is at the moment. But let's say we wanted to move forward and work on environmental laws, which we're doing. We're working with them, NRDC, myself, we're working with the government on moving to the next level of different environmental laws. There's 3 fundamental challenges that kind of distinguish their system from our system, and which causes a lot of us, and again, Professor Percival, I'm sure, will hit some of these same points, and Steve will hit some of these points, causes a lot of us who spend a lot of time thinking about these issues from saying, how do we get past this point? How do we really develop laws that get to the same goal we want to get to in the United States, but account for these significant differences? And these 3 significant differences in the system are the lack of any type of system of federalism, the relationship between the federal government and the local governments, the lack of a really enforceable mechanism for permitting, and the lack of an established system for public participation. And this third one is actually one area which is showing some signs of moving in good directions. So I'm going to hit each of these 3 themes. And the first is the most fundamental underlying theme of our environmental law system, and this is what I lecture on when I'm in China, is our notion of cooperative federalism. And the way I describe it is like this, that the United States has the power to enact environmental laws under the Commerce Clause. And the the EPA laws, the 42, Title 42 laws serve as the floor for environmental protection in the United States. So if EPA enacts a law, everyone in the United States is guaranteed environmental protection at that level decided by EPA, or if they enact the regulation. States, as a general proposition, can become more aggressive or more protective with the environment. They can usually raise the floor above what EPA has set. And our policy, as a general proposition, is to give states that authority. The federal government doesn't want to be micromanaging the environmental laws, environmental applications in individual states. It will if it has to, but it doesn't want to. But the critical provision in this, and this is this fifth bullet that is, the fifth bullet that's the most important, is that the federal government retains an oversight role, so that if the floor is not being enforced in a certain state, the government can step in, take back the program, start implementing the program in that state, can start taking away highway funds, start sanctioning a state, but the federal government can ensure a floor of environmental protection that is guaranteed across all 50 states to everyone. And then we can share responsibility for enforcing these laws against polluters and industry and other people. So this notion that we have a floor that's enforceable is critical to the success of environmental laws in the U.S. The relationship in China is exactly the opposite, where there's national laws, but it's really the local governments, the provincial governments, that have all the authority to decide the environmental policies in their specific regions and to decide how strongly they're going to enforce even national laws. While the government may say it has the enforcement authority, the practical reality is it really lacks it except in the most extreme circumstances. To give you some idea, the US EPA has 18,000 people working for it, and in my prediction in the next few years it probably will have significantly more than 18,000 people working for it, specifically as it takes on climate change. The EPA equivalent in China, the Ministry of Environmental Protection, has just above 200 people for a country with a population four times larger. So 200 people at the national level working on environmental issues versus 18,000 at EPA, and a lot of people think EPA doesn't have enough folks. So it gives you some extent to that resources are being dedicated at a national level to ensuring consistency in environmental laws across China. So this becomes, in my mind and the mind of many others, the most significant impediment to really implementing a strong system of environmental laws in China, this notion of federalism. There's been some ways to kind of get around it, which is the notion of not only rewarding local governments based on economic growth, but also on environmental issues and environmental protection. This has been experimented with on a pilot program. It has not worked out so well so far, but it's an issue people continue to explore. The second issue is one of permitting and enforcement. And again, our laws are based on the notion you can get a permit, and in China they call this the right to pollute. And I think that's fair. I think a permit is probably a right to pollute. We don't prefer to call it that way, but it's not an unfair characterization. And so we have permits, and you get a permit. It goes through an elaborate process, and you can make sure the permit is issued only if you're not going to cause additional harm to a stream above the capacity or additional harm to the air. And we have an incredibly sophisticated system. And if you don't comply with your permit or if you don't get a permit, there's an enforcement mechanism. There's sanctions. It gets litigated. There's criminal sanctions in some cases. There's a very strong stick that pushes people into compliance with environmental laws. I mentioned that I'm working with colleagues at the NRDC and other organizations in China to comment on a new air law that China is proposing to be implemented in the next couple years. And one of the comments we made, and one of the most significant comments, was this very notion that it's going to be hard to advance an air law in China that's going to have any teeth, any effect, without a fully integrated comprehensive air quality management system, including permitting and enforcement. And you can see from one of our comments here, a permitting system is an invaluable enforcement tool, and we go on and on. And again, this is critical. This is, if you're going to have a clean air system, it's one thing to say you want clean air, but if you have no way to enforce it, it doesn't do a lot of good. And so we're hoping that in this new version of the air law, we will see some opportunity for China to start implementing a permitting system across not just provinces, but across the nation. We're seeing a pilot project being tested right now for trading of discharge rights in Lake Tai Basin, which is one of the most polluted areas of the waters in China, as well as a discharge right exchange for air pollution in Tianjin. And the Chicago Climate Exchange actually has a 25% interest in this air permit exchange. So this is, again, another encouraging sign, but a very long way to go. And then finally, the third point on public participation, you know, critical to the environmental laws in the U.S., critical to the environmental movement in the U.S., is the notion that stakeholders have a right to participate in the development of regulations. Our system is based on that stakeholders have to comment on decisions, the government has to respond to comments, has to explain when they agree and disagree, and not just environmentalists, but industry and all types of stakeholders get to participate in a very transparent way of developing environmental laws. This is a fundamental component of our system. China has been less reluctant in history to promote public participation, particularly in environmental laws. But again, this is a trend that seems to be starting to go in a better direction. And there's different reasons for that. One of the reasons, and the Chinese officials are very honest when they say this, is they know that environmental issues lead to public unrest. They lead to protest. And the government does not want protests, particularly on environmental issues. And so one of the reasons they're actually encouraging public participation and experimenting with it is because they don't want the consequences of the public protests and unrest. And they'll communicate that directly and say that's really our driving factor. Well, whatever the driving factor is, there does seem to be some signs of a good direction on this. 2 years ago when I was in China with Steve, the day we were there, they actually published a water law in the national newspapers, and they were very proud of that. They showed it to us and said, this is the first time we've ever actually published a draft law, and that was just 2 years ago. Last year, the Ministry of Environmental Protection actually proposed measures for disclosure of environmental information to govern the agency in terms of being more proactive in disclosing information about plants and facilities and what the agency is doing. And there were even national regulations on open government information. So again, these were all signs in the right direction. Now, there's been plenty of debate about how much teeth there is behind these rules, whether it really applies in the appropriate circumstances, whether they're really being enforced. But the government does seem to recognize that this is an issue to address moving forward. So with that, they are addressing both of these issues simultaneously, and we're going to hear from the other panelists, I think, on some of the specific issues going to climate change and energy and water issues. And there are things that we can observe from them and learn from them. I do think in some ways, maybe not on a big scale, but on a smaller scale, kind of routine day of life things, they have very aggressive energy efficiency requirements in many cities. I think if you spend a typical day in a city in China, you'll find more opportunities to be energy efficient than you would in the U.S. There's tremendous investment in renewable energy and the manufacturing and technology infrastructure for renewable energy. And just the notion of planning. One thing I've always been impressed with in China, whether you agree with their decisions or not, they do plan really well, as opposed to us where we can, you know, wake up one morning and find out a new law had been passed we weren't really aware of. Things are thought out many years ahead of time there, and once they make a decision, they go ahead and implement it, and they spend several years implementing the plan. And I think there's something we can learn from in that. Well, thank you, and I will turn it over to my next panelist here to start talking about some of the specifics.
We were deciding who was supposed to go next, so apologies for that. Well, thank you very much to the host, and thanks for having us here on this nice, lovely rainy day, and thank you for joining us. Couple disclaimers. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't speak to the environmental law, and maybe that's a good thing in some sense. But NRDC has been very active in China for a number of years, and so obviously the key question is why would a major environmental group that's mostly a U.S.-based group be active in China? And if you didn't get it from the pictures, let me give a couple of kind of tidbits that I think sort of paint some context for why China is so important in the whole scheme of things. As many people know, everything in China is big. China is a huge country that's moving very rapidly through the industrialization process. The pace of things in China is just astronomical compared to what is going on in many other countries. You've heard the oft-quoted statistics that China builds 2 coal-fired power plants a week. That's I think definitely a true statistic, or at least it was over the past couple of years. But the scale of that is just astronomical. And the pace of new generation, the pace of new industrial output is significant. For example, China produces over 50% of the world's cement, probably upwards of 60% these days. Steel is somewhere on that order as well. And everything in China is just occurring at an astronomically fast pace. Now, that's changed recently, but the pace of that change has led to many of the environmental challenges that were just alluded to, and I don't have pictures to elaborate that because on the global warming front, obviously, it's hard to show exact pictures. But I think it's a unique opportunity to outline some of the challenges and to move forward in a very constructive way with China. So why should China and the U.S. work together? Obviously, there's a huge backlog of environmental law in China and a huge opportunity, as was just alluded to, but it's very different, and it's a very different context between China and the U.S. We're not the same country. We don't have the same sort of legal structure. We don't even have the same, we don't have the same language. We don't have the same sort of cultural institutions, and we clearly don't have the same sort of government structure. One's a democracy, loosely speaking, in some sense, and the other is not a democracy, obviously. there's a huge opportunity for technology cooperation and environmental law cooperation between the two sets of countries. Much of our work in China is working with them and sort of taking some of the best examples from the United States and mostly often from California and trying to figure out how they would work in China and how you could sort of transfer them into China. So there's a huge opportunity for this sort of cross-fertilization. there's obviously huge challenges in China and between the U.S. For many years, China and the U.S. have been both interlinked and in conflict at times. We have this sort of mutual distrust, but also on many issues, not just on environment, we're very much intertwined. And so it obviously causes a different sort of relationship between how the U.S. and China goes about things, and that obviously mixes in to many of the climate and energy challenges as well. and why do we care about them on the climate portfolio? well, clearly, China and the U.S. are a significant source of pollution. China, just last year, depending on whose statistics you believe, became the number one polluter in the world in CO2 emissions, so they're a very significant source. And the combination of the U.S. and China together accounts for over 40% of the world's CO2 emissions from fossil fuel. They're a very significant source of emissions, and so they, as we like to say, hold, in some sense, the opportunity to keep the world from the brink of global warming or to lead us to a sustainable path. And so there's a huge opportunity, but there's a huge challenge in China. The Chinese government is grappling with many of the fundamental challenges that the U.S. and other developing countries that are in the early stages of their industrialization are grappling with. China has to create a huge number of jobs every year just to keep the number of people that are coming from the rural populations to the urban populations employed. They have to do that not just because that's the right thing to do to pull people out of poverty, but it's a huge source of potential instability, and given the Communist Party's interest in keeping control of the government, that's a huge potential risk for them. And so they have this twin challenge where they know that they have to create a huge number of jobs to keep people employed, but many of those jobs have been moving into the industrial sector, which is a huge source of pollution in China. And so those sort of twin challenges of creating the jobs and on the other side not wanting to forever be the factory of the world is, I think, what China's been grappling with. and the source of China's emissions is predominantly in these energy-intensive industries. The energy-intensive industries roughly account for about 70% of the energy use and emissions in the country. So it's a huge source of their emissions and a huge challenge for them to deal with, because on the one hand, these are the main drivers of their economic growth and the main drivers of their job creation. But on the other side, it's the main drivers of their environmental pollution, both local air quality, as was alluded to, but also in terms of their global warming pollution. And that's a significant challenge for China. So with that context, I think there's sort of three points that I'd like to make to sort of keep keep in mind. The first, and this is probably too obvious to state, but it sort of gets lost in many of the debates. It's, I think, unrealistic to believe that China will lead without the U.S. leading on global warming pollution. This has been sort of very obvious to many of us for a while, but it gets oftentimes lost in the debate. And so why should the U.S. lead when our biggest competitor is not taking similar steps on global warming? And I think, you know, you can go through the rack of many of things on global warming pollution. Obviously, the U.S. has been the largest historical polluter in the world, and China has caught up, but is nowhere near the scale of cumulative emissions. Their per capita emissions is astronomically below the United States, and so forth. But I think from a strategic standpoint, it's unclear, and I think unlikely, that China will not follow or will not take the next steps if the U.S. doesn't. Just from a strategic negotiating position in the climate negotiations, China sits back, they wait, they're ready to take the next step, but they're not going to take that first step until the U.S., as the biggest polluter, is taking that serious step, that they feel that it's in the U.S.'s sort of leadership responsibility to take that first step. And I think, as I mentioned to some folks, I think a number of years, about 2 or 3 years ago, the Chinese government realized that the Bush administration wasn't really serious on global warming, and so decided that they would go along and continue conversations, but their willingness to take that sort of next bold step was very much held back, because why would they take that step when they knew the other partner sitting on the other side of the negotiating table wasn't really serious about this effort? And I think that dynamic's changed, obviously, with the election of President Obama and leaders in Congress that are signaling that they're going to move on global warming pollution. But we're still, some sense, stuck in this dilemma that some folks have called the Grand Suicide Pact, which is that we only move if we move together. And I think that's an important thing for us to overcome. And I think that we will overcome it, because obviously there's a growing momentum for the U.S. to cap its global warming pollution, with members of Congress pushing forward this, and hopefully we'll have a bill passed this year that will send a strong signal. And I think that will change the dynamic astronomically between China and the U.S. on this important issue. When the U.S. is sitting across the table and is actually in a position to say, hey, we've taken the next step, now we want you to not be too far behind us. And that's the tricky conversation, is how much farther behind the U.S. is China, and how fast and at what sort of scale and in what structure does China move forward on global warming. And so the second point that I'd like to make is there's a unique opportunity for the U.S. and China to move forward together. We have China finally, I think, showing signs of its willingness to move forward on global warming. They're small steps. They're not what many members of Congress would like to see them move, but I think that over the past, say, 2 or 3 years, you've seen a growing willingness of China to make progress. As many people used to say to me when I was in China, just pay attention to the simple fact of global warming being in the press in China. It's a huge sign of the willingness of the central government to even talk about global warming pollution. I can tell you from NRDC's experience, those words were pretty much taboo for many years, and I think it's only been recently that we've actually been able to say those words in many of the conversations. The Chinese central government, the Chinese press now talks about global warming oftentimes on the front page of the paper. It's not the dominant theme, but it does occur, and it does kind of rise to the top of the political echelon in a number of the debates. And this is, I think, evident in a number of the things that China has started to do, which aren't driven principally by global warming, but usually have the side benefits of global warming pollution reduction. just to give a couple examples, so in the 5 year, the recent 5 year plan, China set forward an energy intensity target to cut their energy intensity per unit of GDP by 20% over that 5 year period. That's a very significant effort, on the scale that I don't think any of the major countries in the world have ever set about. Over that short of period of time, making that level of energy intensity improvement over that short of period of time is astronomical. And it would produce a very significant global warming pollution reduction. Some people have estimated on the order of 1.5 billion tons of CO2 emissions, which is way beyond what the level of reductions in global warming pollution that you'd see from the European emissions trading system or even in the early years of the U.S. system. And we're talking about by the end of 2010. And all signs are that China will meet it with mixed results, as many things in China, but I think there's a growing sense that China will meet this energy intensity target. Another important factoid to keep in mind, showing China's willingness, China has one of the most aggressive vehicle efficiency standards in the world. When we had conversations with members of the Detroit or members of the Michigan delegation on this fact, I think it was unclear to them that this was actually true. And when we actually showed them the graph that shows the Chinese vehicle efficiency standard is better than both the U.S. standard but also the California standard that will take the U.S. in a much bigger step, that shows some signs of doing that. Now, why did China do that? Not through the global warming lens, clearly. I mean, that was a nice side benefit, but they had a huge import challenge on oil. And so for them, starting to deal with their import imbalance on oil was a significant driver of efforts to reduce their global warming pollution. The third piece of action that China's making that's been very significant on global warming is China's made very significant efforts to expand the amount of renewables in their electricity grid. They still have a major coal problem. Don't disbelieve that. But they have made very significant efforts to improve and to deploy renewables on a very big scale. And most of the major renewables producers in the world now have facilities based in China with some kind of joint venture, and the Chinese technology development of wind generation, for example, is state-of-the-art or close to state-of-the-art in many sense, and is moving up the technology learning curve very fast. They also have a number of efforts to improve the industrial energy efficiency and to close outdated facilities. China has, as many developing countries, oftentimes a sort of twin dynamic in the industrial sector. They oftentimes have some of the most state-of-the-art facilities, oftentimes because of the newest facilities in the world. They were built over a period just over the last couple years as they were going through major economic development. But they also oftentimes have some of the worst energy-efficient plants in the world, and that's very true in China. And so China has been making efforts to both require that all new facilities meet sort of some level of state-of-the-art, but also to close down many of the inefficient facilities that are spread throughout the country. And that's a twin challenge for them, because many of these small mom-and-pop facilities are also sources of employment in many of the local jurisdictions. And just as mayors in the United States have to deal with this issue, how would you close down my facility and put my people out of work, many of the local politicians in China have that same dilemma. And so I think that's an interesting challenge for them. So those are the energy pieces that China has started to move forward with, which are not driven principally through the global warming lens, but obviously have a very strong co-benefit. And many of those have been done for not the climate reasons, but for a number of the sustainable development challenges that China's facing. Imports of oil, air quality pollution, the social unrest that was just alluded to, and those are sort of drivers of challenge. But just recently, China started to signal, I think, a much greater willingness to move forward with global warming pollution. They put out just last year a white paper, which is at the highest level of government paper, which in some sense started to document the set of actions that they were already doing on energy policy and on some on global warming that were having an impact on global warming emissions. But they also started to provide some hints of where I think that they're showing signs of where they're going to go in the next rounds of the international efforts to address global warming pollution. And I think this boils down, not just for China, but for many countries, to sort of a two-part messaging. One is there's a set of actions that we will do on our own. There's a set of actions that we know are driven by our sustainable development objectives, energy efficiency, air quality pollution, oil import restrictions that we need to take the next step to do on our own. We don't need much in the way of international assistance on that, maybe a little bit support with enforcement stuff and some cross-border fertilization, but the vast majority of the mobilization of capital and resources and law reform and so forth will be driven through our own sort of actions. We don't need assistance. But there's a set of things that we know that they need assistance in to go further, that will only take you so far in dealing with global warming pollution. And there's this next step where we need assistance, and that's a very difficult challenge within the China question, because on the one hand, we know that China is oftentimes several years behind in terms of technology deployment. Oftentimes, when you look at the state-of-the-art technology in the world's best, in particular when you look at it compared to Japan, which is oftentimes in many places the kind of leading edge, China used to be on the order of 15 years, 10, 15 years behind. They've caught up. So that they're probably something on the order of 5 years behind the best technology deployment. But there's still this little bit of gap. And part of that is is driven by many, many factors. And some of it is the challenge. When you talk about cooperation with China, you often get the question, so why should I send money to China? Doesn't China own most of the U.S. debt, and don't they own most of our money? So why do we need to send resources to China? And then on the technology side, why should we send our technology to China? Because they're our biggest competitor. They would be sort of a leading competitor of us. They'll just steal our technology anyway, and they don't have intellectual property rights. So why would we sort of deal with, why would we partner with them? And those are definitely a challenge. How do you structure a set of incentives that helps to deal with these set of twin challenges and opportunities? And some of this is rhetoric. Some of it is truly a fundamental issue in China, and I think that's the challenge. How do we sort of unpack this and actually move forward with a set of systems that both moves forward? I think the opportunities and the needs are so significant that we have to find the right policy dynamic to solve this. There's clearly a huge opportunity for U.S. technology providers to tap into the Chinese market. When I said China's big, that also means that China's demand for goods and technologies will be very significant. When we think about the set of technologies that the U.S. is talking about and the number of jobs it will create through the deployment of these technologies, just think if we could deploy those technologies and help to deploy those technologies in China. The scale would be astronomical and the opportunities would be significant. And as my colleague Barbara Fenimore, who's the director of our China program, likes to say, oftentimes, even though the Europeans have had this long relationship, and in some sense actually have a better relationship with China on a number of these issues around energy and global warming, China always looks to U.S. technology. Why do they look to U.S. technology? Well, it's generally viewed as the best, and it comes with requirements that if it fails, that they'll somebody will be held accountable. And so China always is looking for opportunities to use U.S. technologies, despite in many cases actually Europeans and Japanese have much better technologies. But even with that opportunity, they look sort of for us, for our technology to move forward. The next piece that I think is changing the dynamics is there's been a huge economic slowdown in China as there has been in the U.S. China was growing upwards of the order of 10 to 12% per year in GDP, whereas the U.S., just to give you a scale, was 2 to 3%. Most developing countries, India was the next behind them typically, and they're on the order of 8%. So everything in China was just happening fast. They were building these two coal-fired power plants a week. They knew that there was a set of things that they had to do, but there just wasn't time oftentimes to think them through in a rational way and do that. When you have to build these power plants to meet the growing demand for energy, you oftentimes can't make the smart, rational policy and economic choices. And so I think that was always a challenge for China. But that's changed now. There's been a slowdown in China's economic output. They have a huge number of challenges related to that, but it creates an opportunity to now actually have some smart, rational conversations with China that don't need to, we just have to build things so fast that we can't deal with the many challenges that are in front of us. And I think China is taking some steps in that direction. There's been a huge effort across the world to make sure that a portion of the economic stimulus that people are investing in to pull the world economy out of potential recession, out of recession and potential out of depression, on green components. The U.S. passed a number of, or passed a huge portion of its economic recovery with green kinds of things, mostly on energy efficiency, but also renewables deployments. Obviously, we would like it for it, liked for it to be much bigger, but we're very happy with that, with the efforts. And China is following with a number of similar steps. China is investing now roughly $30 billion of their economic stimulus on energy efficiency things, and there's some signs that some of the things that they'll do on infrastructure will move in that direction, but it's unclear. And so there's a huge opportunity and a huge challenge to move to invest these stimulus in green things that lead China and the U.S. and the rest of the world in a very significant direction that's laying the foundation for more to come. Is it enough? No. But it's a small down payment and sends the right signal if you invest in the right things. And just to give an example, we estimate that the U.S. investment in green things will create 1.5 million jobs. Could you imagine how much a similar investment in China would do in terms of job creation? Because obviously the a dollar in China or a yuan in China goes much further in some sense, given the labor cost disparities. So there's a huge opportunity for this to move forward. And I think the third piece that creates a unique opportunity is I think the U.S. is now actually paying attention to China in a constructive way. Just to give a couple examples, Secretary Clinton, one of her first trips out of the box was to China. She made this Asia trip, and a number of conversations in regions and in China were focused on global warming and energy issues. This was at the top of her agenda. It wasn't necessarily always the number one thing, but it was number two if it wasn't number one in some of her agenda. And so it's clear that State Department, Energy Department, and a number of the key officials in the climate portfolio are going to make an outreach to China and working with China a key part of the challenge and a key part of the opportunity. They've announced and they will codify this next month when President Obama and Hu Jintao meet around the G20 meeting. There's serious talk of establishing a much more coordinated and focused bilateral partnership around global warming and energy issues, and we'll wait to see what the details on that are, but I think the signs are positive. We met with folks from the State Department China team. I didn't even know that they had a China team on energy issues before this, and I think that they're headed in the right direction to find opportunities for the U.S. and China to begin to move forward cooperatively and to address these twin challenges of creating many new jobs, but also addressing the various pollution sources, in particular global warming. And so we were sitting there thinking, wouldn't it be nice if we had a roadmap, a path for the set of things that the U.S. government and China should do together to begin to deal with both these opportunities and challenges? And so we put together a set of recommendations, sort of a nine-step path for the U.S. and China to move together cooperatively, building upon our experience in China and sort of drawing some lessons about things that work and don't work and essentially taking the things that have been done in China and bringing them up to a much bigger scale. So I won't go into much detail because you have a paper with the details, but just to give you the set of nine things in a very quick snapshot, and I won't give you all the details. But the first thing is, U.S. needs to commit to a serious engagement at a very high level bilateral approach to China on the key sticking points in the climate negotiations. We need to move forward on a multilateral effort where we're participating in the 180 countries in the UNFCCC, but clearly China and the U.S. hold a fundamental opportunity and hold a key to unblocking the potential sticking points. And so we think that there's a number of opportunities where China needs and the U.S. needs to come together. One opportunity is we need to start to get a grip of how do we deal with this challenge of China wanting technology incentives and the U.S. and other countries not feeling like it's in their best interest to invest in China. Chinese technology because of intellectual property rights, because of competitiveness concerns. So how do we find that sort of opportunity to come together and find a structure that works? I think it's there. I think there's an opportunity to do it, but it's not easy. The second piece is when we think about what China and in particular when we think about what China should be doing in the global warming efforts, many of us have been saying that it's probably not realistic to expect China to take a cap on its global warming pollution in this next round across the entire economy. We have many sources of pollution in China that are just hard to get our hands on. We don't sort of know where they are. We've got lots of data issues. We've got a challenge. The transportation sector is a good opportunity. But if you think about it for just a couple of the key sectors, there's a much better way and an easier way to sort of focus on this. So if you look at electricity, cement, iron and steel, pulp and paper, the energy intensive industries, we have the data, or at least we have the opportunity to collect the data in China. We have to improve that. That's clearly a challenge. But we also know where these plants are. And we know that they're also a big source of pollution in China and a big source of efforts for China to improve their energy efficiency. And so we have this opportunity to start to move forward with dealing with these key sectors of the economy where China could take the next step in reducing the emissions intensity of these sources of pollution and maybe get provided with some incentives to go a bit further, as I illuminated before. The second point, just to briefly touch on this, is a U.S. and China partnership or some kind of collaboration around green jobs. As I mentioned, there's an investment in green components in the economic stimulus across or in both countries. And there's a huge opportunity given the lens through which most of the policy debate now in the U.S. is being driven, that green jobs is a huge driver of the economic growth of the future, and the country that leads on creating jobs in this sector in a carbon-constrained world will be the leader of this next century. And so I think there's an opportunity to illuminate that in China. The third is probably too easy to be said, but energy efficiency. If any time you think about global warming and any time you think about doing anything, energy efficiency needs to be the first thing out of the box. And that's clearly true in China, given their huge opportunities to reduce their energy intensity, but they're moving in some positive directions in there. the fourth is an expansion of renewables. When you think about the first thing, energy efficiency, the second thing you would want to think about is untapping renewable potential. And China has huge potential to move in renewable energy. They have some challenges. They have some opportunities, but there's a clear relationship where the U.S. can help kind of move forward on that piece. The fifth is vehicles and transportation sort of writ large. While China has some of China has the most aggressive vehicle efficiency or one of the most aggressive vehicle efficiency standards in the world, there's still a huge opportunity to improve the vehicle efficiency in China, but also to expand other things in China around fuels, urban transport. There's some efforts around bus rapid transit, and so there's a huge opportunity in the transportation sector. And this is the looming sort of next issue, given that a number of Chinese will be moving into the middle class. The transportation sector is a potential source of big growth of global warming emissions in China. The next piece that I think is important and oftentimes very controversial, but we have to find a solution to coal, not just in the U.S., but in China. And that oftentimes comes back to carbon capture and storage. I think it's unlikely that you'll find a scenario in China that doesn't show coal playing a dominant source of its energy in the future, even if you have significant improvements in renewable and significant improvements in energy efficiency. It's still coal will be there and will be a source of the energy demand and a source of the global warming pollution. So we need to have a solution to that. And that essentially means that at the same time, or at least only 1 or 2 years after we're deploying these technologies in the U.S., we need to be simultaneously deploying them in China. We can't have the typical development cycle where the U.S. and Europe gets them and 10 or 15 years later China gets them. We need to be doing these essentially simultaneous if we're going to deal with this challenge, because the amount of carbon that's locked in when China builds a coal-fired power plant that lasts 40 years is astronomical. The next piece is clearly on greenhouse gas data and transparency issues. There's movements in China to improve this. There's movements to actually get a better handle on their emissions data, but we have nowhere near the level of sophistication in China on collection of these data. And I think that that's a huge challenge, because anytime that China says, we're taking these steps on energy, we're taking these steps on global warming, there's always a skepticism across in the U.S. because when you don't have transparent data, when you don't have a trust in that data, then anything that China puts out is always going to be viewed through a skeptical lens, and I think that that's true. Even though China reports these data on energy use and they've got them on the web now, you talk to a member of Congress and they say, well, I don't really believe it. Is that really true? We don't really know what's there. And so I think there's a huge challenge to do that. And it's not just because of global warming, because, as was mentioned before, it's very difficult to fathom how you would deal with your environmental pollution if you don't actually fundamentally know what is happening on a plant-by-plant basis. What kind of energy are they using? How much air pollution are they? How much global warming pollution? So this is a fundamental building block of anything they would do. The next one, probably too small to mention, but I think it's an important opportunity, is to begin to do much more in-depth analysis with China around the co-benefits of moving on these policies. It's not true across everything, but most of the things that you would do for global warming pollution have a nice benefit in terms of air quality pollution reduction and oil import reductions, and so there's a huge opportunity to move forward on that. And given that for the foreseeable future, that will be the main lens through which China will evaluate its global warming pollution, I think there's a huge opportunity to illuminate that and to move forward. The last piece is, once again, probably too easy to say, but there's a huge opportunity to expand the exchange between the U.S. and China on environmental law, enforcement of these laws, and much of our work in China is bringing folks from the U.S., like my colleagues here, to China to help them understand and educate them on what the U.S. is doing and how the enforcement goes forward. Any effort in China to deal with this has to deal with the enforcement challenge in China, because while many of the central government folks are very interested in deal with global warming, they have the challenge of enforcement at the local and provincial level, and they've made progress, but they're not quite there yet. And so I think that's an important challenge. So obviously, as we look, and the lens through which I look through many of these challenges is, we need to be moving forward very quickly on coming to a solution to global warming. Global warming, by nature, is a global issue. That's one of the lead words in it. And so that means that you have to have China as a part of the solution. And as we look to Copenhagen, the end of this year, where the world is set to agree to a new international agreement, we need to make progress with China at the same time that we're making progress domestically in capping our own pollution. And so the time is limited, but there's a huge opportunity for the U.S. and China to move forward and work proactively and constructively and to start to unblock some of these challenges, but to also create a number of opportunities to move forward. We think it can be done. We think it needs to be done. And I think that there's a huge opportunity to move forward over the next couple of months. And hopefully Secretary Clinton and President Obama will take that opportunity to move forward. So with that, I'll end and let you have questions later. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning. First of all, I want to thank the organizers of this conference for inviting me to attend. This is a terrific event, a terrific set of panelists. And actually, I want to also thank my fellow panelists for sort of setting the stage for my talk. We didn't plan this, I swear. But as it turns out, these talks fit very well together because the first two speakers talked sort of about China writ large, about environmental laws in China, about the development of policies for environmental protection in China. And I'm going to take it sort of to the local level where these laws and policies are going to ultimately have effect, but actually, as in the case of China, where many of them are going to be formed. As you can see, my talk starts with a quote, "I've drunk the waters of Changsha." When I was researching for this talk, I came across a poem about the Yangtze River, and my talk is going to center on our work in the Yangtze River. And this poem is by that well-known poet, Chairman Mao. And the first line of the poem is, "I have drunk the waters of Changsha." Changsha is a city located in the Yangtze Basin. And the reason that that sort of struck me, that was the first line in Chairman Mao's inspirational poem about the Yangtze, is that if Chairman Mao was alive today and went to the banks of the river at Changsha, he probably wouldn't want to drink the water. In truth, the Yangtze River has a tremendous pollution problem. And it's really one of the potential obstacles to not only public health in China, but economic growth. There have been several studies done that have looked at the dramatic economic growth in China. And one of them, at least, has determined that one of the major threats to that growth, this was done before the economic downturn, but it will still remain true when the global economy turns around. One of the tremendous obstacles to growth in China, to continued growth, is water. That is, in terms of the supplies of water needed to fuel their industries and also the water quality, because oftentimes if water is of too poor a quality, it might as well not be there at all. So it's a tremendous potential obstacle to Chinese growth. Now, what I want to do first is talk a little bit about WWF and the work that we do around the world and focus it on China and the Yangtze in particular. WWF has offices in about 50 countries and works in about 100 countries around the world on a variety of conservation issues, the conservation of biodiversity, the prevention of pollution, the prevention of wasteful use of resources. Now, the program that I'm most directly involved in is a program to improve water management and improve the conservation of freshwater ecosystems in 7 river or lake basins around the world, which is shown here. And one of them, of course, is the Yangtze. The Yangtze, just to give you some fun facts, is the third longest river in the world. It's a center of tremendous freshwater biodiversity. And perhaps more important to the daily lives of Chinese, 400 million people live in the Yangtze Basin and depend on the river and its waters for a large amount of protein in their diet through seafood, as well as agricultural production. The Yangtze Basin really is the breadbasket of China. It provides, I have a list of percentages which I won't go into because they'll just boggle you, but essentially it produces a tremendous amount of the cereal, the grain, the meat that goes into the diet in China. It's also a tremendously large geographic area, 7 times the size of the UK, as you can see. But the Yangtze River is faced with tremendous problems, really problems for all of China. Water quality is a tremendously serious problem in China. Very few of the open waters in China are fishable and swimmable by the standards that we're familiar with through the Clean Water Act. And again, it's been recognized on the national level and at the provincial level that it is one of the obstacles to public health in China and to continued economic growth in China. So what I'm going to talk a little bit about is what WWF and some of our partners are doing in China to try to address some of these issues. And just to talk a little bit about the approach that our WWF China office takes to these issues, and just by way of a little background, WWF was the first environmental NGO invited into China about 30 years ago. We were invited in to do some of the first scientific studies ever on panda populations. And develop plans for panda conservation. And since then, our operations in China have expanded exponentially. We now have over 100 staff there and 9 offices around the country working on a variety of environmental issues, including water and water quality. And the sort of four-pronged approach to our work in the Yangtze Basin is developing field projects, working at the policy level, engaging the private sector, and then developing a communication strategy to get the Chinese public involved in conservation. And the way these play out is we try to change local behavior, change the relationships of local people toward natural resources, toward water, and then building on that to change the policy setting. Those are the two things I'm going to talk about today. And hopefully these will lead to a transformational change in the way these resources are managed. To start at the local level, this is a map that the WWF China office developed with local leaders in 2 small villages on the Minjiang River, which is a tributary to the Yangtze. And the real issue facing this community was water quality. Decades and decades of agricultural pollution, industrial pollution, was rendering the water unfit to drink and unfit for all the uses of water in our daily lives. And this was a serious problem for this community. So the WWF China office established a relationship with the community, opened up a small office there. This took some time. It takes about a year and a half to develop the relationships and the level of trust necessary to do this sort of work. But because there was a mutual need here seen on the part of both WWF China and the community, it was a fairly successful effort to develop this partnership. The first step was to develop a tool like this, a map that shows how the community, the situation of the community, and how the community interacts with the water resource. And as you can see, this is a part of the Batao River, which is a small tributary of the Minjiang. You can see how it threads through their community in many different ways, in many different places. And you can see when you learn about the culture of these communities that they're very attached culturally, spiritually, as well as economically and for health reasons, to the river. But, of course, this goes beyond making maps and talking about the significance. We needed to develop concrete solutions to try to develop, no pun intended here, to address the water pollution issue in this small village. And here are a couple of ways that we did it. This is a biogas production facility. That's a sort of a highfalutin word for a waste disposal system at the household level. This is a pit built behind a house with some equipment installed in it that all the household waste as well as the waste of the local animals goes into this facility. The methane gas that waste produces as it breaks down is then used for cooking and heating in the home. So it's sort of a win-win situation in that it turns the waste into a fuel source for preparing food, for heating the home. And then it also captures a lot of the waste that would have otherwise gone into the river and breaks it down and turns it into something beneficial. So again, this is at the household level, a practical way to reduce the pollution that household is sending into the Yangtze. It also has energy-producing benefits. It also has a greenhouse gas benefit in that this form of energy produces much less greenhouse gases than the wood burning that they traditionally have done. And it may even become ultimately the source of greenhouse gas credits in an emission trading system that may develop in China. So it's a win-win in a lot of ways. Another example, this is essentially an artificial wetland created at a household level to purify gray water as it comes out of the house, take out many of the pollutants which are either metabolized by the plant life or captured in the artificial wetland facility. So that, again, the water being discharged into the Yangtze from this household is substantially cleaner than it would have been before this facility was created. Just another couple of examples of the public awareness raising that's... Oh, I lost my picture. Oh, there we go. There we go. Oh, I've still got pictures up here. I'm sorry. I'm dealing with the various forms of technology. This is an example of some of the community outreach projects that we've done. This is in partnership with the local Coca-Cola bottling plant in the Yangtze. We have an extensive partnership with Coca-Cola here as well as in the other river basins that I mentioned. This is essentially a map of the local river basin. And children can come to the Coca-Cola plant. When they're touring the plant, they come to this room and they play this game. This table you see on the left picture actually breaks into many component parts. And it's all mixed up. And then the children put it together like a puzzle. And when they put their section, these little tiny sections are all on wheels, when they wheel their section into place and put it in the right place, they get to turn it over. And on the other side of this panel, you can see some of them turned over. There are interesting facts about the local river basin, about how it fits into the greater Yangtze. There are facts about water conservation. There are facts about pollution prevention. I've played this game. It's a lot of fun. And it's a great way to educate the local community, starting with the children, about the importance of conserving water quality and quantity in their village. There's also a community-based report that they put out on the Baitao River on essentially looking at a number of key factors, sort of a scorecard of water quality and water quality in the river, and a scorecard of some of the projects that are underway along the river to conserve it. Again, this is something very new in China. This is one of the first things that was produced. It's an example of sort of a community empowerment, which is generally sort of starting to happen in China. Local communities are taking more of a role in managing their own natural resources and are more and more being allowed to put out products like this that actually sort of extol what they're doing, dramatize the problem, and motivate action. Also in the village, as a result of this work, there has come together a group that is really sort of taking ownership of their reach of the Baitao River and developing some management tools for the local river. It's essentially a local natural resource management council or water council. Again, it's a new movement in China to manage resources at the local level. This is something that a lot of these folks have never experienced before. They've never experienced this sort of local empowerment, the sort of thing that in the United States we've taken for granted of getting things organized at the community level, whether it's through city councils or through NGOs. It's starting to happen at the local level in China. And this is a group that's working together to develop and expand on some of the pollution control techniques I talked about before on a community-wide basis. So what does this mean for water quality in the Yangtze in general or in China in general? Well, one of the things that's so exciting about this work is it's really an example of potential bottom-up development of pollution control measures that could ultimately have a basin-wide and even a nationwide effect. Let me give you a couple of examples of what I mean by that. In addition to developing and demonstrating these local community-based techniques for water quality improvement in the Yangtze, WWF is also involved on the provincial and the national level, sort of bringing these local experiences into the national level policy discussion in a couple of ways. One, WWF and a variety of partners in China just signed a memorandum of agreement with the Ministry for the Environment on safe drinking water, which will provide an opportunity for WWF to bring these local community advocates into the discussion at the national policy level on safe drinking water. Another example, the Yangtze Forum the symbol for the Yangtze Forum is up here in the upper right-hand corner. The Yangtze Forum is a meeting that meets once every 3 years in the Yangtze Basin to bring together the national government, provincial governments, the private sector, communities, NGOs, to talk about these sorts of solutions to water quality and quantity problems in the Yangtze Basin. This Yangtze Forum has the ear of provincial and national governments, and I believe we're moving toward a point where the Yangtze Forum will actually be proposing policy solutions which can then be adopted by the national government and implemented at a large scale. And this is where it all fits together. And this is sort of the bottom line of this work at the village level and how it can be scaled up. One household in the Yangtze doing a biogas facility or doing an artificial wetland isn't going to have much of an effect on water quality in the Yangtze. That's true. But if you sort of step back and think about the way China is developing right now, there's a middle class in China now as a result of the economic growth over the past 20 years. There's a middle class in China that is larger than the population of the entire United States. That's remarkable. But it leaves 800 million other people who are still living in relative poverty and are living in places like this village I just talked about, that are living in local communities and that are interacting with natural resources on a very visceral level. And it's among these 800 million people, as much as the growing middle class, where these gains are going to be made. If the Chinese national government were to develop laws and regulations requiring these sorts of biogas facilities and these sorts of artificial wetlands at the local level and provided subsidies to create them, the impact on water quality in the Yangtze Basin could be tremendous. And it's through mechanisms like the Yangtze Forum and the Safe Water Drinking Memorandum with the Ministry of the Environment where this is going to happen. Again, it's an example of WWF's approach, which we're taking all over the world, sort of hooking up local projects to provincial and national policies. And there are very few places where it's more promising than in China through the work at the village level going all the way up to the national government. And again, this is an example of this. In my view, this builds nicely on the other two talks we've heard today, because on the one hand, we're building this environmental law framework, but then we've got to populate that framework with practical work at the local level. And this project, in my view, is a really nice combination of those two things. Thank you very much.
I'm Michael DeStefano. I'm our symposium editor at SDLP. I want to thank these gentlemen for coming out again. We appreciate your time. We have about 10 minutes for any questions. If anybody has anything they want to ask, we have some microphones, but it's a pretty small room, so if you shout, we can probably hear you anyway.
I had a question. There's an enormous project about the damming of the river in China now. Now, they displaced, as I understand, 1.5 million people. So the first question is, under what authority did they do that? Did they just do it? And secondly, is the purpose for that to improve the water quality or energy, or what was the purpose behind that huge project?
From what I'm aware of, and I've been to Wuhan, which is the province where the Three Gorges Dam is, it was primarily an energy project as well as a flood control project to some extent, but my impression it was more energy focused. In terms of authority, the for better or for worse, China always seems to have the authority to do what it wants to do. And in cases of, you know, environmental contamination or emergencies, they can get in there faster than we can and resolve it. But also, if they want to do something that we may not think of as very environmentally beneficial, they have the authority to do it. It is amazing in China, there's a tremendous amount of pride in the Three Gorges Dam project, by and large. It's considered a civil engineering feat, an enormous sense of pride for the nation. And so when you talk to folks about it there, you'll generally hear very positive things and not hear very much about the relocation of people. I would imagine from a wildlife perspective, it's probably something that you guys have focused on to some extent.
Yeah, it's as he said, China is an authoritarian government, so which can lead to things like the displacement of populations to get out of the way of a dam. Potentially, that authoritarianism can also be harnessed to do things like require the sort of the biogas and artificial wetland facilities I just talked about. So there's definitely there's a little bit of good and it mixed in with a lot of ill about the authoritarian regime in China. As far as the dam was concerned, yes, it was primarily an energy generation dam, and it's and to the extent that it had any flood control elements at all, that's turned out to be a bust, quite frankly, because in fact the displacement of water of flow through the Yangtze because of the Three Gorges Dam has had really pretty devastating environmental impacts in terms of everything from reducing water that gets to Shanghai, which has caused the aquifers there to, excuse me, has caused the river flow there to recede so much that you're actually getting saltwater intrusion into the water supplies in Shanghai, to the fact that that it's channelized the entire river, so you've got massive erosion and the channel of the river is getting narrower and narrower and deeper, and these were certainly unintended consequences. So there is a lot of pride in the Three Gorges Dam. It is considered sort of an engineering marvel, but from an environmental standpoint, it's a decidedly mixed bag.
Hello, everyone. Not a question, but some individual viewpoints. Firstly, I remember just now one professor say China is the first polluter in the world. And I would say I agree China is the first polluter in the world, but I would say China has the largest population in the world and make a great contribution to the production of the world. Again, China has about 1.3 billion people in the world. And additionally, it's sad for the United States of America, 5% of the population of the world is consuming the 20% energy of the world. I don't know if it's real or not. Frankly speaking, Chinese government has made and is making progresses in the protection of environmental law. More important, last year, Chinese National Congress passed the Circular Economy Law, and 2007, I remember, we passed the Clean Production Law, and last year, the State Council of China, issued the plastic ban, a plastic bag ban. It means since June 1st of 2008, any stores, any supermarket cannot provide plastic bag to the consumers freely. I think this is a great progress for Chinese government. As I know, in the United States, every time I go to the supermarket, the supermarket, close to WCL, I can get plastic bag freely. And another individual impression, I don't know why, for American houses, the air conditioner runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. When I came to DC last year, the weather is fine outside. I opened the window, but my landlady said, no, you cannot. But I don't know why. It's the problem of safety or security. The DC society is not safe. There are many criminal cases. I don't know. But I feel it's safe. I I hope I can get American professors answer why Americans' houses, the air conditioner runs any time, any day, through years. I don't know why. And another again. I think there is a great opportunity between China and the United States. We know the United States is the most developed country in technology, in science, in the world. We know. And we also know China is the largest developing country. It needs technology of the protection of the environment. Frankly speaking, for China, we have a relative legal system of protection of environmental law. The main problem maybe is the enforcement of the law. And additionally, we may need add some specific legal system of protection of environmental law. It's true. And I would tell everyone, China is becoming greener and greener. Tomorrow is beautiful. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of, I don't know if this works, yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the challenge. I mean, if you look at the amount of cumulative emissions that have been added to the atmosphere, which is the real measure of global warming, because it's all about, you know, how much do you add over, 150, 200, 300 years, and China's nowhere near. I mean, China's number three. They're not, you know, inconsequential, but they're about one-fifth of the cumulative emissions that the U.S. has emitted since 1850. So the major stockpile of global warming pollution has been contributed by the United States and Europe largely, and to a lesser extent China, but that's mostly over the last 50 years and vast majority. But that's the challenge. Is that and I think that's why China has a unique position, which is that what we're asking of China is not the same as what we're asking of the United States, Europe, and the other developed countries, because we've been the vast contributor to this problem. We need to step up and be the vast leader of this. But we also need the major developing countries at some point in the very near future to begin to help with us. And that's why the conversation around global warming at the international level is not, hopefully is not about China needs to do the exact same thing that the United States and Europe does at the exact same moment, but China needs to, and this is where I think the U.S. can help, is China needs to grow, but in a less dirty way in the next 20 years, and lay the foundation for even significant cuts in the future. And not sure exactly how Secretary Clinton stated this, but she essentially said something to the effect of, we want to help you avoid the mistakes that we made in the past. And I think that's the more constructive framework of sort of how do we move forward together. It still means that we have to deal with this, because we can't just simply say, we can't deal with the emissions from the developing world, because if you look into the future at any point, if developed countries' emissions went to zero, we still would have a global warming challenge if you look at if the developing countries did nothing. Now, it doesn't mean that you don't have to deal with the developed countries' emissions. It just sort of puts that into context, because you have to deal with that. And I think that's where the political dilemma is grappling with, because many of the members of Congress want China to do the exact same thing at the exact same moment, And that's not realistic because of the statistics that you illuminated. And it's probably not even the right sort of political ask. But I think that the ask has to be, how do we help you reduce your emissions intensity over the next couple of years so that you're not making the many of the mistakes that we are, and that we're also simultaneously deploying the set of key advanced technologies so that in 2020, 25, that when you go to build, you know, your economic development, that you have the state-of-the-art technologies there, that they're deployed, that they're cost-effective, and that there's an opportunity for that. And, you know, I think that that's both the technology challenge, but I think there's also, you know, the enforcement challenge. I mean, you can illuminate as well. But, you know, most of the U.S. environmental history is that we devolved power to local governments, and we realized that local governments didn't do enforcement, and so we kind of devolved much of the authority to have some backstop of federal enforcement of these activities. And I think that that's, you know, a twin challenge in China because, well, you mentioned they have, you know, on a number of fronts, some of the best things in the world. The vehicle efficiency standard is top-notch. It's most aggressive. They have very aggressive, you know, for example, building efficiency standards in Beijing. But on the same hand, in a city the size of Beijing, they have 4 enforcement officers. Maybe it's grown, but the statistic that sticks in my head is 4. And so you have these twin challenges. And that I think, is the fundamental challenge in China is I think there's a growing awareness on global warming and energy issues that the central government is moving in a positive direction and wants to deal with this and take some steps, but they still have a slight enforcement challenge. It's improved, just the enforcement over the last couple of years has been, you know, astronomically better, but they still have that challenge. And it's not unique in that sense to China, because we had the same challenge in the United States, where we had local governors and mayors that didn't want to enforce the laws. And so we kind of, you know, encouraged them and through various tools we have. But I don't know if others want to illuminate on the enforcement piece.
Maybe illuminate on one other piece too, which is I think you've raised some very fair points, and you're right, China is doing a lot of things good, and we've heard about the energy efficiency issues they're doing well, and I'm not a person to say we're all good and they're all bad, and I think it's much more complicated than that. I do think the one kind of general observation I have, though, is the notion of pursuing economic efficiency, economic growth over environmental protection, that well, where we in the U.S. have come to see these as mutually achievable goals, both economic growth and environmental protection, in China they seem to believe they're more counter purposes, that it's hard to do both at the same time. And a lot of the things we hear about energy efficiency and other things are not driven because of environmental reasons, I think, but because of economic reasons. And so I think part of the challenge we all have is to share technology and share ideas to show not only can you grow your economy, but you can improve the environment at the same time. They're not mutually exclusive goals.
No, that's actually what I'm spending most of my time on. back in last year, there was an agreement in Bali to launch and commence a new international agreement on global warming in Copenhagen this year, in December this year. It's not like, you know, I think it's unlikely the U.S. will sign on to the Kyoto Protocol, maybe if we change it to the Phoenix Protocol or something, as some people have suggested. But it's largely a tainted name, not because it's not the right thing to do. But the structure that I think will emerge is very similar in some sense to what the Kyoto Protocol does for developed countries, which is basically we're going to put a cap on our global warming pollution and be held accountable to that. And I think President Obama has signaled that he'll move in that direction very fast, and members of Congress are moving in that direction. It's unclear whether or not it will get to the finish line before Copenhagen, and that's the big question that's on everybody's mind. But there's progress, and hopefully we'll come to a conclusion on that this year. At least that's our sort of wish and hope and political ask. and then the opportunities for getting an international agreement are significantly improved. And so I think the agreement in Copenhagen will have the fundamentals of developed countries capping their pollution, because we have to, because it's a historical responsibility, and we need to show that kind of leadership. And then the challenge is how do we construct a framework that helps and works with the developing countries to move down that path so that they're not, making the same mistakes that we made, but also at the same time taking on a greater share of responsibility over time. And that's the twin challenge, and I think that's what Secretary Clinton and her special envoy, Todd Stern, and other leaders around the world are going to be grappling with, is how do we to move forward with both the U.S. capping its pollution, but also working with the developing world to begin that transition, and how to structure that. And that's the negotiation, and we'll see who blinks first and kind of how it all comes together. But
I'm going to cut us off there just so we're somewhat on time.